Nope. Seen it. Oh, nah.
Can't find something to watch? Introducing Sky Stream. It's Sky without the dish. Watch unmissable Sky exclusives like The Regime and Netflix too, all over super reliable Sky full fibre broadband. Get Sky Stream, Sky Broadband and Netflix for just €50 a month. Search Sky Stream. Availability subject location. New customers only. 12-month minimum term. Stream and broadband sold separately. Further terms apply. For more info, see sky.ie/speeds.
Seachtain. An Indo Ascaelige.
Time I mon iroachtaí a dhéanamh teacht ar a chorp. Agus súligam amach an seo, gur féidir é a chur in uaig ceart lena bhaintir féin.
Scíltaí, fios, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhféadfach ara i gcuirna meáin an cheist sin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam a gnám go raibh orthcháir na reachtam. Iadach sé tarraing go raibh an orthcháir san i lis dúthail agus gimine fanacht gór a chlig sár ducha sin éachar. Ná ní bhin ann thar d'oraach sin, bhin marav.
Seachtain. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
If you like the Indo Daily, you can follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today on the Indo Daily, poisoned, pushed, or shot dead? How Putin's enemies meet an untimely end.
Gunfire and explosions have been heard here and in the second city of Kharkiv shortly after the Russian President Vladimir Putin authorized a special military operation in Ukraine's Donbas region and told the Ukrainian military to lay down their weapons and go home.
Friday marks a year since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Vladimir Putin's grip on power has come under sharper focus, along with the tactics he uses to deal with dissenters.
Russian military official Marina Yankina has reportedly been blamed for the Kremlin's worst losses in Ukraine. She's believed to have fallen 160 feet to her death from a high-rise apartment building.
Alexander Litvinenko had been working as a spy for MI6 when he was poisoned with the radioactive substance polonium-210.
It is now clear that Mr. Skripal and his daughter were poisoned with a military-grade nerve agent of a type developed by Russia.
I'm Fiona Onchain, and today on the Indo Daily, I'm joined by Jason Corcoran, freelance journalist and Russia analyst, to ask what becomes of Putin's rivals and critics.
They have a whole array of methods to take out people, and it was in the full armory since Putin's been in power since 2000. The likely tactics are, well, there's a bullet to the neck, there is pushing you out of a window, pushing you down the stairs.
Jason, without getting into James Bond territory here, are there certain hallmarks of state-backed assassinations in Russia?
Yeah, I think there is, especially the ones, the extrajudicial assassinations would take place overseas. And they tend to be, you know, KGB FSB officers who are sent on a specific mission to take out Vragnarodov, enemy of the state. And that could be anybody from a dissident to a former Chechen military figure who was on the wrong side of the war. Or, you know, a journalist or a civil activist.
Do you think, you know, events like falling downstairs, to what degree can we put this down to the higher echelons of the Kremlin all the way up to Vladimir Putin? Or is it being carried out by lower ranked intelligence officers on the ground and not really getting clearance from on high?
I think it's a little bit of the latter. And I don't think every mysterious death or suicide in Russia can be accounted for by suggesting it was the KGB, FSB who knocked them off, or it was Putin who ordered it, because, you know, he has probably has a long list of people that he'd like to knock off, or maybe his associates would like to knock off, but he doesn't have the time at the moment. The Russian system and the business community is under immense pressure now due to the war. These are very stressful times for everybody. And I think, you know, in some cases, that there have been, you know, sort of assassinations. But it's possibly more logical to think that because of the war, there are the competing clans who were fighting under the rug in the Kremlin are now fighting in public for assets which are either being nationalized or being sold very cheaply by multinationals who are leaving the market. So there's lower cash available for these guys, and they've got less certainty about the future. Who's going to be in charge of the kleptocracy in a year's time. So these guys, they're settling scores and competing more viciously, and they're using some of the hallmarks of FSB assassinations to make the actual crime sort of unclear as to who actually did it.
Yeah, I suppose these murders, if they are murders, they can also serve as a warning to people that what happens if you cross people. What about the Kremlin's reach? I mean, is it possible that part of the message here is that wherever you depart to in the world, I mean, in the old days it would have been called defection, now it's called just emigration, that they can reach out and get you?
Yeah. Putin is, he really hates treason, and he hates people who are considered traitorous to him. And certainly some of the figures we've seen who have defected, and I'm thinking of Sergei Skripal and Andrei Litvinenko, the former worked for the GRU military service and the latter for the KGB and FSB, and they would be considered enemies, traitors to the cause. And Putin wouldn't have forgotten what they've done in the past. I think definitely, I mean, there has been evidence, you know, linking those to the state. And Putin has said some things about both of those figures on the record, calling them traitors. So, you know, he has a very long memory for people who worked, particularly in the Chekist service, which is the origins of the FSB, KGB, because Putin himself, as you'll recall, he started out as a KGB officer and he ran the FSB in St. Petersburg before he became prime minister and then president of Russia.
You mentioned Litvinenko. Can you take me through that case? I mean, it was such a high-profile case. How did it happen? And ultimately, looking back on it now, who do we think was responsible for it?
Mm-hmm. Litvinenko, he was an officer, as I mentioned, with the FSB, the successor to the KGB, and he'd fled to the UK because he'd become a critic of the Kremlin and of Putin. And he'd been investigating links between the Russian mafia and their activities in Spain. And he'd also accused Putin of the apartment bombings, which were these mysterious bombings which happened in the early 2000s, which were they fingered the Chechens at the time, but it was said that it was actually the FSB. It was an inside job to scare people into backing Putin. And he also claimed that Boris Berezovsky, who was the guy who actually put Putin into the Kremlin in the first place, the sort of great cardinal, that he had foiled an assassination plot against Boris Berezovsky. And this was before Boris Berezovsky fell out with Putin and fled to London. And Litvinenko then went to London and sort of joined forces with Berezovsky and was sort of a bit of a whistleblower.
And ultimately, he was targeted by the Russian state services, even from as far away as being based in the UK.
Yeah, there was two guys who were sent on meetings with him, Andrei Lugovoy and Dmitry Kovtun. I actually met Andrei Lugovoy 2 years later in Moscow. So these guys had a couple of meetings with Litvinenko in London, and they allegedly administered radioactive polonium 210 into a cup of tea, which Litvinenko drank, and then he fell ill and started vomiting, and he had a slow and very painful death, which was reported around the world. But these two guys, they were in London for a few days. They went to an Arsenal match, and they had sushi, and they went to a lap dancing club, and everywhere they went, they left a trail of polonium 210, like Hansel and Gretel with their crumbs of bread all over London.
This is the report here, and the conclusions are quite startling. The principal conclusion here is that President Putin was probably involved and probably called for the assassination of Alexander Litvinenko in London.
That was then followed by the now infamous Salisbury poisonings. Again, similarities in terms of what was used. So in this case, you mentioned the name already, Sergei Skripal. he's a former Russian military officer and a double agent for British intelligence. And then his daughter, Yulia. And they are living in the picturesque and historic city of Salisbury. Take it from there. What happened in that case?
Yeah, so Skripal was very high-profile defector. He'd given secrets to the MI6, which was a big crime in Putin's eyes. So in the months after the poisoning, because initially when it happened, everybody was shocked, but it was completely unsure what they had been poisoned with. Scotland Yard sifted through thousands of hours of CCTV coverage, and they found two Russian men who had arrived, I think, in Gatwick. And these guys had flown in from Moscow to Gatwick, and they want genuine Russian passports and visas. And they turned out they were undercover operatives traveling under assumed names, Ruslan Bashirov and Alexander Petrov. And they had a weapon, which was Novichok, which they administered through this perfume bottle. And they apparently had sprayed it on Skripal's door. Unfortunately for the Russians and for the assassins, it didn't kill the Skripals. But the perfume bottle was tossed by one of the two individuals into a rubbish skip, and an Englishman found the perfume bottle, and he gifted it to his wife, who unfortunately died in very tragic circumstances.
Russia's record of conducting state-sponsored assassinations, and our assessment that Russia views some defectors as legitimate targets for assassinations, the government has concluded that it is highly likely that Russia was responsible for the act against Sergei and Yulia Skripal.
Alexei Navalny, tell us about that case. And again, seem to be certain similarities.
Yeah, I think so. Navalny is the Putin's nemesis in Russia. He is the only real opposition politician who's put it up to Putin in his 23 years in power. He has brought out 250,000 people on the streets of Moscow, which is unheard of during Putin's reign. So he ran to be mayor of Moscow, and he won 28% of the vote, which was unheard of as well for an opposition figure, because it's all systemic option. It's, you know, really sort of just puppets. So he was traveling around Russia trying to raise opposition in the regions in Siberia and outside of the power structures of Moscow and St. Petersburg. And he was being tracked by FSB operatives. And so I think Putin had decided he had enough of Navalny and he was going to take him out. So apparently one of these operatives, it was discovered afterwards, he actually confessed to his role in the plot. Because Navalny, with the help of Bellingcat, the investigative website, actually rang one of the attempted assassins afterwards, and he confessed that he had revealed to Navalny that he tried to poison him by spraying Novichok on his underwear in the hotel where he'd been staying in Omsk in Siberia. So Navalny, with the help of Bellingcat, actually rang one of these operatives and pretended to be his boss from the FSB, and the guy he confessed into his role in the attempt assassination.
Finally, President Putin did respond to our investigation, and what was extraordinary was that he didn't really deny any of what we had suggested in terms of specifically this elite team of operatives following around Alexei Navalny. He said it would be normal for FSB operatives to follow around Navalny because he claims Navalny is working with U.S. intelligence services.
There's a long and colorful history of the use of poison in Russian affairs of state. I mean, you can go back to Rasputin over a century ago. Is it now basically a calling card for the Russian intelligence services that where people are being poisoned, the suspicion immediately falls on KGB, FSB?
Yeah, I think poisoning has that sort of ambiguity. So it is concealed. It's really hard to detect, especially some of these new agents. Whereas, you know, pushing somebody down the stairs or defenestration is less ambiguous, because it could be an accident or it could be suicide. But with poison, we know that, you know, the Russian state has these laboratories, whole armory of poisons, which are designed to trigger, I don't know, everything from fast-acting cancers or to trigger cardiac arrest or even these psychotropic drugs, which can destabilize enemy targets. And then these substances, which take a long time to their slow acting, so they're kind of mood changing. And then, you know, the relatives of the target, they can report afterwards that, oh yeah, the individual, he was suffering for weeks and weeks. He wasn't quite himself. And he had this profound depression, which again conceals what actually happens.
And of course, over the last 12 months, we've had a series of high profile suicides, falls, and so on following the outbreak of the war in Ukraine. What do Russians believe when they hear of these suspicious deaths? Do they just do they just take it as fact that this is what happened, or are people skeptical at this point?
I know from speaking to my friends and relatives, and they're talking about a return to 1990s style banditry, when the country went through shock therapy of free market economic reforms. So then you had assassinations were commonplace on the streets, and you know there was queues for food. There was very little food. The banks were collapsing, and you know, and we're seeing that again. Okay, the economy isn't collapsing, but it is heading into terminal zastoy, stagnation. So you're seeing, you know, companies leave. People are increasingly unemployed because they're masking it, because there's been sent on unpaid leave and they're getting less hours. And real unemployment is said to be 10% or more, whereas the Kremlin says it's officially 4%. So you're seeing in this milieu the reemergence of mafia. And the mafia are guys who work seamlessly with the KGB, FSB, and sometimes they're indistinguishable from one another. And there's turf wars now happening and protection rackets. And recently there was two huge alleged arson attacks on two of the biggest shopping malls in Moscow. The Mega Mall, which where IKEA was in Himki, and Balakaya as well. So they're suspected to be arson attacks by, you know, rival clans who want to get the assets, or it's an insurance scam. So there's lawlessness creeping back into Moscow, certainly, and other parts of Russia. And people are just keeping their heads down. They want to block out the war. They don't want their son, their father, their brother to be called up to be mobilized. My brother-in-law, incidentally, he fled to Turkey just months after the war because he didn't want to be caught up in it.
What about any serious rivals emerging, particularly in the past 12 months, on the anti-war side or politically?
Unfortunately, not. I mean, the all of the anti-war guys, liberal politicians, have been either locked up or have gone into exile. And then you've seen, since the mobilization, general mobilization in September, a reported 1 million men of fighting age have fled, mainly to the former Soviet Union, neighboring countries like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Georgia, Armenia, and because they don't want to be in the war. And these are the kind of guys who may have protested and who did protest last year in March and April initially in Moscow and St. Petersburg. But now Putin has no patience for these. Before, he would allow some level of protest. Now, because the so-called special operation has been going on for a year now, and he has limited resources and limited time for opposition. So they're being clamped down upon now, and people who even mention the war could face 6 years in prison.
And what about Putin's inner cadre? Is there any suspicion there that people, anybody is getting too strong and could perhaps take him out in that regard?
Yeah, well, the only suggestion really of anybody who could change things would be a sort of a palace coup, that you could send some military junta who could take place, and you could be worse than Putin, or they could want peace, they may want to travel again to Saint-Tropez, shop in Paris, and want a quiet life, and they could, you know, conceivably free Navalny from prison and ask him to be a go-between, to have some sort of amnesty. In the meantime, I think what we're seeing is the ones who are the biggest threat to Putin are the ultra-nationalists, the ones who think he should be bombing more civilian targets in Ukraine and, you know, maybe even bombing Kiev. Joe Biden visits Ukrainian capital. They think that he's not going far enough. And there's a number of these figures who have blogs and they're on Telegram channels and they're tolerated because they have accretion. They have protection from within the security services, so they can't be touched. And these guys are, I think, the biggest threat. And they also include the head of the Wagner Group, so-called Putin's chef, Yevgeny Prigozhin, and also the Chechens, who I mentioned before, led by Ramzan Kadyrov.
So Putin's focus on the war, it has the potential to destabilize his position, but you're not buying it that that anything imminent is happening.
No, I think because he has a ring of steel around him. And since the COVID pandemic, he only sees a small handful of people because he's absolutely paranoid about getting sick or getting a virus or getting even a common cold. So you have to spend a week in isolation, allegedly, before you see Putin. And so the people he converses with and he talks to are, you know, the head of the FSB and the head of the Foreign Military Service, the GRU. And these guys, they're like an echo chamber. They tell him what he wants to hear, and they're no threat to him. When he travels abroad, Fionnuala, and he only travels now to China and to the East mainly, but when he travels abroad previously, it's been reported that he has four or five people who follow him into the toilet and they collect his stools and his urine. So it gets sent off to a laboratory in Moscow just to check that what he's eating and consuming is okay.
And my thanks to Jason Corcoran for joining me today. I'm Fionnuala Sheehan, and today's episode of The Indo Daily was produced by Mary Carroll, researched by JJ Clark, with sound by Gavin Hennessy. Archive clips from the BBC, ITV, CNN, YouTube, and Independent.ie. If you enjoy The Indo Daily, don't forget to like, follow, and leave us a review.